So I'd like to speak tonight a little bit about the relevance of meditation and the teachings in daily life. And I will include some of the questions that you wrote yesterday. So the first one is a question, and I'll read it in a minute, about relating to people. And I think it's a very important question, because aren't we really in constant state of relationship? And not just to our partners and children and parents, but life is relationship. That's the whole teaching of dependent co-arising. We're in relationship to all that happens, to our thoughts, to other beings, to the environment. So perhaps in reflecting on this question, it may shed some light on just the general state of relationship. And I think, boy, this world needs a lot of reflection on relationship, I think. So the question, how does one let go within a friendship or a marriage? How does one let go within a friendship or a marriage? That isn't quite like letting go of a fly buzzing. How can you build a family or commit to anything in the long term alongside the idea of letting go? So this is a question that comes up over and over and over again. And actually, I remember the second retreat I sat with Goenkaji. I very timidly went up and asked him basically this question. And is he Burmese or is he Indian? I know his teacher is Burmese. So he comes from a very traditional Asian background. And he sort of looked at me, and I don't know if he actually patted me on the head, but it felt like he patted me on the head. And he said, "Oh, don't worry, just get married and have a family and everything will be fine." So that's not my answer tonight, my reflection. So this question about how does one let go? And I think letting go just happens when it happens. And the question may be more relevant to ask. It's more about not clinging and not grasping. And what is the understanding that leads to not clinging and not grasping? Once something isn't grasped or held on to, the letting go happens. And I think that's what the teachings and the practice offer. The understanding which leads to not clinging and not grasping. And I think the difference between a fly and a person in terms of relationship and letting go is we're usually a lot more attached to the person than the fly. There's a lot of history in that relationship, much more involvement, and lots more emotions. But isn't the underlying relationship to both the fly and the person, to all things and to life itself, basically fundamentally the same? So can we find a way? Can we be in relationship lightly? Remembering the teachings of impermanence, anicca. remembering and understanding the teaching of dependent co-arising and dependent co-passing away, not only as it happens, as it is happening for me, but also for the person I'm in relationship with. And also the dukkha of expectation, the dukkha of attachment to outcome. So putting these three together, the anicca, anatta, and dukkha, which are the fundamental teachings of the Buddha. As Norman has said many, 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 many times on the retreat, if we deeply know the experience of these, if we deeply know and understand that everything is impermanent, everything is changing, that everything is arising because of conditions and passing out of existence because of conditions, and the conditions themselves are constantly changing. And this explains why we say that all things have an innate kind of unsatisfactoriness, because we can't hold on to them. And if this is understood, can this shine a light on the way we relate to relationship? I think a good question to ask is, what is a commitment? What do we mean by commitment? And how does that relate to these teachings of impermanence and dependent arising and dukkha? So for me, the word commitment means promise. And one that's made in good faith and in good trust. But knowing what we know, hopefully, after these days on retreat, about impermanence and about none of us, any of us, anybody really actually being in control, knowing that everything depends on everything else, can we depend on commitment? Can we completely find security in commitment if the word commitment means promise? Can we hold on tight to it? When Norman and I got married, before we got married, we really took a good look at what it was we were willing to agree to. And really took a good look at this word commitment and responsibility. And what is it that we could say in the marriage ceremony that would reflect what we know in our experience and what we respect in the teachings to be true? And what we came to was that the word commitment, we couldn't use that word, because especially for me, having been through a marriage already that, you know, started out with very good intentions, but through changes, it wasn't supporting us, and the decision was made to separate and to lead separate lives. And so that word commitment as a promise didn't ring true. And so what we felt okay with was making an intention, aiming towards something with sincerity and in good trust and in good faith. So the heart was very present with that. And we knew that the feeling was there, the intention was there for commitment, but that we knew conditions change, everything can change, and we couldn't make the assumption that that commitment would be present forever. And so the words that we used, we wrote our own words, and it was an intention, a heartfelt aspiration, a wish. May we live in truth and trust and respect and love. So that's not a promise. It's may we. It's voicing an intention. And it felt to us that it was possible for that to exist, even if the form of the relationship changed. That we were willing and wanted to be able to live in truth together and with respect and trust and love, even if something happened and we didn't stay together. And the second intention, I don't remember exactly the words, but it was something like, may we be a support to each other emotionally, physically, and spiritually. And that too felt like we were willing to make that commitment, that intention for commitment, even if the relationship changed form. And in order to honor that, that understanding that things change, every year on our anniversary, we have we reflect together about whether these two intentions are still, we can recommit to them, and whether we can recommit to the relationship in the form that it has been in the form of the marriage. And if there's anything that we need to look at, anything we feel we need to address in ourselves, or that we wish the other person would address. And so that leaves great space for being present with how things are. And it gives great space for us to really check in with ourselves from a place of heart, not from a place of promise, to keep it alive. And it's been an incredible, incredible process. So for me, a good relationship is kind of a dance of the deep listening within and to each other, and in keeping alive the teachings of non-harming. So checking in with myself what it is that I feel is important for me in the context of the morality, the ethical foundation of the practice. So not to just make myself the center of the universe or the center of the relationship, but to include not only Norman or whoever else the relationship is concerning, but as big of a circle as possible. So this keeping alive the non-harming in speaking and in actions, non-harming to myself, to friends, partner, children, parents. And to me that includes not clinging, not grasping to views and opinions, to my way of doing things, to my way of being, as having any more importance than anybody else's. And also keeping alive the teachings of kindness and patience. Patience. Patience with myself, with the other person, with the relationship, with the coming and going of everything in life. The comings and goings of the suffering and the happiness. And, as I said before, keeping alive the ethical foundation. And I think, too, that understanding that even if the form of the relationship changes, relationship continues. So even if Norman and I decided no longer be together, we're living at opposite ends of the world, that relationship still exists. Different form, different intention, but relationship doesn't end. And I think this is really important, especially when bringing a child into the world. A child may be brought into a very happy, stable family, but maybe something happens to the fabric of the family. But the relationship, the connection, still remains with all the people in the family and with the responsibility. And so can the commitment or the intention be for the well-being of all, in whatever form or structure evolves, together or apart? And a good form to refer back to is the Buddhist teachings of the Eightfold Path. To really, if there's a question about, you know, is this a wise thing to do, just to check back. So there's wise understanding, the understanding of anicca, anatta, and dukkha. Wise intention, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood. And this is really important. You know, we spend hours and hours and hours every day at a job, and we bring whatever happens on that job home with us, and with us in all relationships. And so this is very important. Wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration. And the one other thing I'd like to add about any relationship is avoiding extremes. The Buddha talked about the middle path and not taking up one extreme or the other, or denying either. The middle path. And two more of the questions are relevant to this middle path and avoiding extremes. Excuse me. Very dry. And they're about wise effort. How easy or difficult must one be with himself? Where do you draw the line? How much giving in to your desires must you do? For example, when I'm tired and I want to sleep, should I go to sleep or should I stay? I think in terms of the retreat, should I go to sleep or should I stay in the meditation hall, stay with the practice? All of these questions create a confused mind. And this and the next one, these are questions, again, that come up over and over and over on retreat and in life. So the expression, good things come easy, may sound good, but I've tried that all my life only to find out it only works up to a point, and then effort is then required. So where is this point in practicing meditation? And I would say also in living life. So these questions are questions that we try to address just very simply in the instructions that we give for sitting meditation. We begin almost every instruction with give attention to the sitting posture. Try to sit upright, yet be soft and at ease. Or like with the meditation practice, be awake and alert, yet open, at ease, not struggling. So in a way, with each of these, we're presenting sort of two extremes. And we're saying, try to find a balance between them. It's also like No, that's complicated. Forget that one. I think it's really important to know that there's no formula. It's not two parts of being upright and three parts of relaxed and easy. I can't give you a recipe because, like everything else, it depends. It changes. What's needed is mindfulness to really know what's going on, to be really honest, to look at what's happening, to look at what's needed, and allow a response to come in the present moment out of the present conditions. So there are times that taking a nap is really appropriate, and there are times when staying in the meditation hall is really appropriate. So asking, what is wise and skillful and non-harming in this situation, and that isn't a real extreme? So, if you're feeling dull and tired, one way is maybe you need some more gentleness. The way of more gentleness, which would be to open the eyes, to stand up. Wait, I'm not connected to this. Wait one sec. Okay, so supposing you're sitting here and there's the experience of being very dull and tired. You have different choices. You can, as we've said, stand up, open the eyes, go for a walk, try to get some energy going, and if that doesn't work, you can go to sleep. Take a nap, go to your room, have a nap, and then hopefully that will lead to more wakefulness in the next sitting. Supposing you're feeling dull and lazy. So it's important, this is where the mindfulness and the honesty comes in. The dullness, the expression in the body is still the same, but there's a different edge to it. And so if you're feeling dull and lazy, then perhaps more effort would help. Doing standing meditation for a long time and letting the sensations really show, to bring more interest, to bring more connection, more wakefulness. I think one of the most important things to ask when this question comes up about what's wise effort is to ask, what's my intention? Is it just to have pleasant sensations? Or is it because liberation is important? And so what would be the wise effort for liberation? So that's one example. And in every situation, to ask that question, what is my intention? And then not to contract around the not knowing the answer right away. Not needing to have a definite answer. Holding whatever the question is. Do I go this way? Do I go that way? Which is the wise way? Which is the wise action? Which is the wise effort? To hold the question very lightly. There's a wonderful riddle. How do angels fly? And the answer is because they take themselves lightly. So it's that holding the questions lightly, allowing some spaciousness, and just see how you fly. And also to know if a response comes, okay, this is what seems appropriate. and it turns out it isn't so appropriate, okay, so then try a little bit in a different direction. You know, there's flexibility, and there's the ability to respond in any moment, in any situation. So it takes the wisdom of experience as well, and also, again, patience, patience, patience. So the last question that I would like to reflect on with you touched Norman and me very deeply. And I think it may very well be in the heart and mind of many of us. How can you trust life when death is all around you? How can you let go of the feeling of self when it's the only thing that keeps you from going crazy? The countries are falling. They're no longer taking care of you. The families break down. All we have these days is ourselves, don't we? This is the voice of despair. This is the voice that comes from just overload of the heart, overload of suffering, overload of hatred and violence. No wonder this question comes. And I think just to really open to these questions, just in opening to the questions, can really touch the heart. So what came to me is that death is a part of life. And in times like these, when there's so much drama and so much horrible excitement and violence and exploitation and cruelty, one stands out more than the other. Fear constricts the heart. And in that place of constriction, it's so difficult to really connect with the life of the individual, and the life of so many of us around, so many people around us, to connect with life in its expression in nature, in children, in connection, in kindness. When the heart is constricted in fear, it's closed to almost everything, and so it's hard to touch the life and all the aspects of life. It also points to the reality of life, that is there really any place that we can stand? Is there really any security if we deeply know that things are always changing and not in my control? But so much of the way we live our life gives us the feeling that yes, I'm in control. I go home. I know what's going to be waiting for me. I know who's going to be there. I know where I'm going to live. I know what my job is going to be. My family will be there. My friends will be there. And I will be there. And never, not in Israel, not in Canada, not in Zimbabwe, not on the moon. Do we know this for sure? And so, in a way, this insecurity, which is so painfully a part of your life, is pointing to something very important, painful, and not what we want to see and not what we want to acknowledge, but it's the truth of things. Can death be a reminder of the fragility of life and the preciousness of life, of this life, of this breath? And also a reminder not to take it for granted, but to live it fully, to live it with heart, and to live it wisely, to make each moment and each breath count. And to know that maybe we can't count on our families, maybe we can't count on our country, but maybe we can have some trust in, have some faith in Sangha, like-minded community, that each individual may not be here and available at every moment we feel we need someone. But Sangha and the teachings, these are available. These are truly, truly available. And perhaps this is a place to put some wise effort, wise intention and wise effort, to bringing that more into our lives. People who see and understand life the way we do, the way it feels is supportive of life and supportive of me as an individual. And in this way, we can help each other, because there sure are moments when I feel lost and confused, and I want to be able to have someone meet me from a place of understanding. And it's reciprocal. It happens together. And so to really look for bringing this more into our life. And I'd like to read a poem by Mary Oliver, who's an American woman. Oh, I don't know if you've ever heard of her or have read any of her books of poems. But I think she comes from a very strong Buddhist background, whether it's learned Buddhism or intuitive Buddhism. And her poems are incredible. And a friend sent this to us by email. And it's called Wage Peace. Could that be translated? I don't know if... Just even that phrase, wage peace. Okay. Wage peace with your breath. Breathe in confusion and breathe out maple trees. Breathe in the fallen and breathe out lifelong friendships intact. Wage peace with your listening. When you hear sirens, pray loud. Remember your tools, flower seeds, clothespins, clean rivers. Make soup. play music. Learn the word for thank you in three languages. Learn to knit and make a hat. Think of chaos as dancing raspberries. Imagine grief as the outbreath of beauty or the gesture of fish. Swim for the other side. Wage peace. Never has the world seemed so fresh and precious. Have a cup of tea and rejoice. Act as if armistice, act as if peace has already arrived. Don't wait another minute. So perhaps the most important thing to take home with you after retreat is seeing what the quiet here, the stillness, being alone and being mindful has touched and brought alive in you. And to have the intention for creating time at home for that, to be quiet and still and alone and awake, awake to life. Time for deep inner listening and also listening to others. Time for patience and time to be and to experience life being and life changing and life arising out of and in connection with all life. I think most of you have seen here how everything changes or can change so quickly. Mood, emotion, thoughts, experience. And it's so clear. How can we hang on to anything? There's nothing that I can call mine or me. Not the pleasures, not the experiences, and not the dukkha. And I hope it's so clear that the dukkha is the trying to hold on or the trying to get rid of. In the place, in the moments of non-grasping, the moments of not knowing, the moments of not taking up any view of me or it, the moments of just being present, haven't you experienced that the most simple things touch the heart? Watching the ants, watching the clouds, hearing a bird song, seeing someone smile, experiencing a smile just arise, helping somebody, little tiny gesture. This just being present can bring such joy and aliveness. The heart can ache with the opening as it unwinds. So I really encourage you not to worry about or try to figure out or struggle for liberation. Not to worry about or try to figure out or struggle for life, but to live simply in respect and peace with all beings, and to be kind and generous. And let this be the true expression of understanding, the true expression of the Buddha's teachings. I think this is the true experience, the true understanding of the practice. As I reach out to touch you, your happiness and appreciation touches and nourishes me. And we both then touch and affect others. This is the true expression of the interconnectedness, the interdependence of all life, the non-separateness of life. And I think the same thing happens when we open to beauty and creativity and even to suffering. When we open to suffering. So the tools and techniques that you've learned here or you've heard about here, don't worry about them. What you need to remember will come to you if you give it the space and the mindfulness, the attention. It will come. But do invite kindness and generosity. And do invite allowing yourself to receive from others and from life, and then watch it spread. And in the midst of so much suffering that we see and experience personally and in the country and globally, keep the heart alive. Keep the metta and compassion flowing. Mm-hmm.